What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Orale Bo Heights. Today, I am here with Lexis Oliver Ray, reporter, photographer for LA Taco. Lex, how are you doing this morning?
Doing all right, man. Another day.
Another day. We're here at Unidad Park in Filipino Town, which is really quiet right now. But then, it's also in the pandemic.
I know. This park was actually shut down, I think, earlier on in the pandemic for a few months.
For obvious reasons, right? People were congregating in spaces and they wanted to maintain, you know, spread and people interacting with each other. So, yeah, I mean, right now there was two folks hanging out, just catching some rays. And then now there's like a couple over here walking their dogs. Hopefully they pick up their poop. But yeah, Matt, thank you so much for making time, for being on the podcast. I know you got so much going on, and it means a lot to me, because you know you're just out there grinding and writing and taking photos, or sometimes you're just out there riding your skateboard and getting like food late at night.
Yeah, like last night, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, dude, so let's get right into it. This last month of October, you were just writing. Well, the stories were published in October, but you were working on them before that. So you were just grinding from like what, like September, maybe August, just working on these stories? Because it's not something that like it took you a couple of days. It probably took you longer to write, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I had to like make a choice to either kind of focus on the short term and the long term. And I decided to go with the long term and really just dig into some deeper investigations. And also just like make the decision not to put out that initial like quick story and to kind of look at it and look at stories a little bit deeper. So yeah, it was like a couple months of writing and then getting the stories out more recently.
Yeah, so some of the things you wrote in the last month or so are you took photos of altars around LA for Hyperallergic. You wrote about the Flora L. Thompson Foundation, which is a foundation that donates money and supports nonprofit organizations, arts-based organizations, and at the same time also funding right-wing organizations that are like super pro-Trump and super problematic for LA Taco. Then you did a deep dive of like the LA District Attorney's Office with the history of like the racism, the scandals, the bribery, all that kind of stuff that makes a good movie for the appeal. Then in between all of that, you were also simultaneously covering different protests as they happened for like Black Lives Matter over the summer, for George Floyd, and like the different protests that have been coming up, popping up over the last couple of weeks, and as well as when the Dodgers won and then when the Lakers won as well. So you were out there. And you also, we'll talk about that a little later, but you also had like some violent altercations with the police at some of those rallies. Then you also are part of a group show at the Mac Center called Demo. You have a couple of photos there. And then you just published this about a couple of days ago on how BIPOC folks of color are arrested and basically marginalized by the police at higher rates than like other folks who are usually tend to be white, given that, you know, for the what, like a year or two now, 3 years, weed has been legalized, but these problems are still the same.
Yeah, they legalized it in 2016, but it took a couple of years to really start to see legal dispensaries and stuff like that. But they've basically been enforcing cannabis, you know, pretty similar to how they did before when it was illegal or in a legal gray area.
Yeah.
And you know, black and brown people are typically the ones that are arrested for cannabis still in Los Angeles.
Yeah, we'll get to this a little later too, because this is one of your beats where you not only do you review like different strains of marijuana, but you cover essentially the beat of like how things are happening, things are shifting. The law has given new businesses new opportunities to do different things with it, but at the same time, the disparities are still the same. It's those who are white, who are affluent, who have the money, who are able to tap into these resources, while everybody else gets left out and is not only left out but still criminalized. So is that I did want to ask this for your beats. Did you like did you decide, oh, that's what I'm going to write about? Is that something you just kind of felt like you naturally were able to cover easily? Like, how did you figure that out?
Yeah, a lot of it was just sort of natural. When I started writing about homelessness, I was producing short documentaries. And at the time, I was I made a documentary in Skid Row. So when I started to write, I was like, what am I going to write about? Okay, I have this inn in Skid Row. I know some people. I'll go hang out and look for stories.
Yeah.
And that just kind of snowballed into meeting more people and finding more stories and realizing that it's something that I want to write about and something that I have access to.
Nice. So it's a kind of what I figured, which is like a natural progression of you were working on something and then because, yeah, you already had those connections established, it was easier for you to keep moving forward and like talking to different folks and diving deeper into the issues as opposed to like starting fresh and trying to figure out from the ground up.
Yeah, and I also recognize that like a lot of people, like not many people were talking about some of those issues. Because I mean, even a couple years ago, coverage around homelessness was a lot different, I would say.
Yeah, depending where you're reading it from. It can either be it's really bad and nobody's doing anything about it. A lot of statistics about folks, you know, transitioning into houselessness especially because of the pandemic and like the economy tanking and everything. So I think with you weave those kind of facts into your stories, but I think for you, you centralize more the people that are being impacted by this rather than like this is another face who can provide, you know, facts for my data. Because for you, it's usually the other way around. You're using facts to help establish the person's story. So is there folks that have stuck out for you in some of your stories that you've been writing?
Yeah, there's people that I've written about. There's also people I haven't written about. I mean, there's before the pandemic, you know, my process is usually just kind of like walking around and trying to meet people and find stories. So there's a lot of times when I do meet people or do some reporting and it doesn't actually turn into a story.
Yeah.
There's one story that stands out. About a year ago, a homeless man was found shot and burned to death.
Oh, damn.
In Van Nuys. So the Times put out a story just kind of about, you know, the coroner's report, just the facts of what happened. And I went out to Van Nuys to try and find out more information about what happened. So I ended up kind of digging around a park in Van Nuys, kind of on the outskirts where there's an encampment. And there's an encampment, but also like poisonous spiders and, you know,
oh,
like,
dang. So you're out there.
Yeah. It was like, it was a mission, but I ended up meeting this guy who lived out there, and he fell into homelessness because he got sick with cancer.
Damn.
And he used to be a recording engineer that actually like worked with the Rolling Stones and a lot of like really famous musicians, but got sick and lost his place and had some relationship problems. So I ended up talking to him for hours and, you know, found out a little bit more about the person that was found in Van Nuys, but, you know, also learning about his story and what happened to him. And that never turned out to be a story, but it's something that really sticks out to me. And I often wonder, like, what happened to that person, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, you're there for the time you're talking to them and you get to know them. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard to keep up with folks. Everybody's always in transition and moving. And I mean, it's a scary reminder to me because I've always been in that situation where, like, you're one bad moment away from like falling into homelessness, right? You know, you lose your job and that's like the snowball effect of like things just falling apart from one to another and it just doesn't stop. So for me, it's scary, man. Thinking about it.
Yeah, I remember him saying that exactly, like that people don't understand how close they are to becoming homeless. It's just your one paycheck away, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, your landlord, your boss, a lot of folks that are in your life, you know, helping you live the way you live, sometimes are just one decision away from like cutting that underneath you for so many different reasons. But yeah, do you ever feel like you're carrying these folks' stories even though you're not publishing them?
What do you mean by carrying them? Like,
right now you're telling me that, so
yeah,
it's kind of like when you meet folks who are going through so many different things, but you know, nobody really stops to listen to them and hear them out and to listen to what happened to them. And for us, for reporters, for storytellers, you know, we're usually the ones talking to as many people as we can and listening to them and trying to get them to tell us their stories, for, you know, for a lot of different reasons, for working on a story or just to genuinely, for me, like I've been in situations where I genuinely just want to listen to folks and, you know, hear them out and hear what happened.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, that example in Van Nuys, that was a situation where, you know, it was really difficult to get people to talk, and then I found this guy who wanted to talk to somebody, you know. As I mentioned, he got sick, he had cancer, and I mean, when I was talking to him, he told me that he only had like a couple of months left to live.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, which, you know, I wanted to spend time with him and just hear him out and hear his story. You know, not necessarily for a not necessarily to write about it or to publish it, but it felt important to hear him out.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a gray area sometimes when you see like those social media accounts like Humans of New York and like other similar accounts where they're trying to put a face behind like people's stories and share it. So I mean, it's a fine line to balance, because it can get exploitative sometimes, because you are putting it out on social media and you know you want folks to like it and share it and all, and support and all this other stuff. But do you ever feel like that when you're talking to folks and then trying to get them to open up to you? Because I'm pretty sure they probably feel that way. They're like, oh, here comes another reporter trying to get me to say something.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important for me to like establish some sort of a connection with somebody before, you know, I start interviewing them. You know, I want people to like me and to feel comfortable to a certain extent, I would say.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm cautious of that, and I mean, I think just naturally, my personality is, you know, I wanna feel a connection to somebody. I'm otherwise, you know, a little bit shy, or
yeah,
you know, it doesn't feel right to be interviewing somebody that I know is not necessarily comfortable.
Yeah, just probing and probing.
Yeah,
which is really the opposite of what you do as a journalist. You know, we're just like here's my question, just tell me what I need to know. Yeah?
Yep.
Being very direct and concrete to it. But yeah, dude. So let's rewind it back a little bit and get to know you a little better. Where did you grow up?
So I actually grew up in Connecticut.
All right.
Yeah.
was it a big town, small city, small town?
Oh, small suburban town. Yeah.
Nice. How did your family end up there?
So both my parents were living in New York, and I mean everything on the East Coast is just so close. So it's like if you live and work in New York, your options are kind of like New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island, if you want to live like outside of the city.
Ah.
And they're all kind of similar, you know. There's not a huge difference between the suburbs in New Jersey and Long Island and Connecticut. I mean, although they're completely different states and, you know, the laws are maybe a little bit different. So my family, they ended up in Connecticut. They were in New Jersey for a bit. And then, they settled down in Connecticut. And my dad continued to work in New York City, like commuting.
Wow. Was it a long commute?
It's about like an hour and a half, like door to door, maybe.
90 minutes, maybe 2 hours.
Yeah.
That sounds like just getting here from like downtown to Santa Monica. On a regular
day. Exactly. That's like how long it took me to commute when I worked in Santa Monica from here. Exactly. Yeah, that's what most people do. It's like, you know, they work, they live maybe in the suburbs and then work in the city, commute every day.
That tripped me out. One of the first few times I went to New York, I took the mega bus to Philadelphia for the day. It's like,
yeah,
dang, this is, yeah, it's not what we used to do here in LA, where you could just like take the bus, usually take the bus to the next city over and shit. But
yeah,
man, that tripped me out. So what was it like for you growing up there?
I mean, when I was a kid, like up until a teenager, it was cool. I mean, I grew up with like a big backyard and
nice,
a bunch of siblings, and we could ride our bikes like all over town when we were kids.
Sounds like an episode of Stranger Things.
yeah. Kind of, exactly. But then as I got older, you know, suburbs are really just like, there's not much to do. You feel kind of trapped. There's not like great public transportation. It's just...
Yeah, almost sometimes non-existent.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not designed, like it's not designed for walking.
Yeah, there's some places where like there's not even a sidewalk.
Right? Yeah, exactly. You're like on the street and cars are driving super fast. So as I got older, I wasn't really into it. And yeah, I mean, it's for me is the kind of place where I knew I couldn't stay there for very long and I had to get out, you know. Like some people in LA, they live here their whole life and, you know, they enjoy it, they like it. But Connecticut and where I grew up is kind of the opposite, where it's like people want to break away from
as soon as you can, you want to get out of there.
And yeah.
What were some of the options you had for leaving? Like,
I honestly didn't have that many because I wasn't a great student. So, you know, I applied. Most people, they take the college route.
Go out of state.
Yeah, go out of state. But for me, I didn't have a lot of options in terms of school. I just kind of knew that I wanted to go to art school and applied to a few schools and ended up getting into the School of Visual Arts, thankfully, which, like, I mean, that's what got me out, basically.
Nice. What were you taking classes, like art-based classes in high school?
No, I wasn't. I actually went to a private school, and we didn't have, like, any, like, music or art or anything.
That sucks.
I mean, there was, like, one art class. It was, like, the first year you take, like, just, like, a drawing, painting sort of class.
Something, like, introductory.
Yeah, but it was very academic.
It was like, you gotta get the right shot. I remember being in an art class in high school and the teacher just yelling at us. Like, it was like some, Hell's Kitchen kind of review thing where you take your drawing up and they're like, what is this shit?
I'm yeah.
Like, you didn't get the, they're that like doesn't look like an apple. Yeah. Like, yo, man, I'm just a teenager trying to draw. Still life sucks. Let me draw some anime.
Yeah, right. All those teachers probably ruined a bunch of potentially really great artists.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially in the arts, you know, it at a young age, it doesn't take much to like really disenfranchise you and really make you feel really, really conscious about what you're trying to do because sometimes it's so personal.
Yeah, I mean, even in, I went to film school, School of Visual Arts, and, you know, you feel that too, even at an older age, I feel like. Because so much of it is just based on feedback and like critiquing,
yeah,
and yeah, just like hearing other people's opinions, which is can be really great and constructive. But I saw a lot of people just kind of give up. You know?
I mean, there are good and bad ways to give somebody feedback. So it's from the sounds of it, it sounds like people are just getting like that negative feedback. It's like this is shit, crap, whatever. Blah, 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 blah. Like being really negative and down about somebody's work who is essentially is in school to learn to improve and get better.
Right. Yeah.
What was it for you that you wanted to go into film?
I mean, I was at the time, I'd been making like videos, you know, some documentaries and stuff, and I was shooting photos. So like going into college, I was kind of unsure if I wanted to be a photographer or a filmmaker.
Oh.
And, I mean, even for my first couple of years, I was considering being a photo major. But like I said, I didn't have that many options, and I just kind of saw filmmaking as, like, one of my only and, like, something that I was really interested in, so.
So where did this passion and love for photography start for you then? It sounds like you were been doing it since you were young.
Yeah, pretty much my whole life. I got started shooting photos, and my mom gave me my first camera, actually.
Oh, no way!
Yeah, and I grew up with...
It wasn't like a disposable camera, it was like a...
My first camera, I think, was a Holga, so it was like...
Oh, that, nice!
You know, a plastic camera.
Yeah,
but,
I have
yeah.
one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're great, especially for beginners. So, yeah, my mom gave me my first camera, and she was a photographer at the time, and I actually grew up with a dark room in my basement.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
So
did you like smelling the fumes?
Lost my headphones.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. That's something I enjoyed when I took film class in college. And you know, you're in the dark room and you're working on your stuff. And at least at East LA College, they would always play like really cool music, like Pink Floyd and stuff like that.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think like the lights really intrigued me. I mean, it just felt really like a really cool space to be in, especially as a kid. Like,
it's solitary too. I mean, yeah. Sometimes you're just developing film on your own.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I miss dark rooms.
Did you ever stumble? Because I always had a hard time with the first step, which is being in complete darkness, getting the film out of the camera and putting it into the canister.
Yeah, that's like the hardest part, right?
It took me like a good while to get the hang of that.
Yeah, that's the hardest part for me. And especially like without, like when you're just using a changing bag and not even in a dark room.
Yeah. Oh, dang. I never got to do that. I was doing it in school, so we always had really cool, at least at the time, up-to-date facilities of like, there's a whole room to do all of that, and yeah. You can be safe, and you know, that's what I really enjoyed about doing it in school, because everything is provided for you. The chemicals, if you need assistance, somebody like a student assistant is there, or somebody that's supervising can help you out, so a lot of resources. I still want to go back to, well, not at this point, not anymore, but because of the pandemic, but go back and just take photo classes, because you have access to the dark room and so many resources.
Yeah, that was one of the best things about art school, just like the amount of resources that we had available to us for free. Well, not for free, because we were paid shitload of tuition.
You got to pay for your own photo paper and all your own film. That was the one thing I was like, damn, this is getting expensive, like taking all these pictures and printing them. And, like, if you make a mistake, damn, that's out of my pocket.
Yeah, I know. I think each one of my images costs, like, $1 or $2.
Oh, dang, that's getting expensive.
Yeah.
But, so you grew up with photography. So then that was, like, an easy transition as you started getting older to pick up, like, a film camera and started taking videos?
Yeah, as I got older, I started with videos, like, more heavily. And then...
Do you remember what kind of cameras were you using for video?
Yeah, back then, man, it was like VHS cameras, you know?
The shoulder mount?
Yeah, the shoulder mount. I remember editing projects like on two VHS players.
Dang.
Yeah, I got really into like, you know, just like creating little homemade movies
and
stuff.
Nice. What were you shooting back then?
I mean, I had a bunch of siblings, so we'd kind of just like... I remember once we shot this, like, a recreation of a music video, like a P. Diddy music video or something. You know, just dumb stuff.
The fisheye lens.
Yeah, exactly. Just, like, just dumb little stuff. I actually found a VHS camera recently that still works, and it just blew my mind to, like, look through the lens and see, like, the quality of cameras back then.
Yeah.
But it's cool because it's, like... You know, it's really all about storytelling at the end of the day, and you could still create, like, a great film on a VHS camera.
I mean, now I think that's something that people would be more interested in, because, like, oh, wow, you're doing it old school. Oh.
Yeah, there's been a resurgence. And
it's not an Instagram filter.
Yeah, that's real.
when you were in college, in what city was it?
I went to school in Manhattan.
All right, We went from high school, like, directly to college and then just went over. Were you commuting to New York back and forth?
No, fortunately, I was living there. It was a really abrupt change. Like, all of a sudden, I was going, because I took a year off in between high school and college. Mm. And, I went from just being in the suburbs with, like, nothing to do to, like, 5 days later, I was in Manhattan living on my own.
Dang, that's a big switch, especially living with siblings.
Yeah. I mean... It was weird because at first it was something that I wanted for years, you know, but it took me
nothing around here.
Yeah. But then once I had all that freedom, like, I didn't know what to do with it. And it took me like a couple of years to really enjoy living in the city and to like really embrace it.
When was this? This is like what, 2000s?
This was 2009. Yeah.
Dang.
My first year.
Yeah. So you were living in New York pre 9/11. No, wait, after 9/11.
After 9/11,
after
yeah.
9/11. I forget, because I was
right,
in high school.
Right after, it was like right during the last major depression, 2008.
Oh, that's right.
When everything crashed. It was a really interesting time to be in New York and to be a student.
A lot of hard times for a lot of folks. Jesus.
Yeah, seriously.
What were like some of the things you remember from like living in New York at that very specific? That's a very specific time.
Yeah, it was a very specific time. I remember that things were still very expensive, and like a lot of students were just shocked by how like difficult it was to get an apartment or anything like that. I remember just like having a lot of fun, you know, like it was really hard to be a student and also be like right in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah. You have all this newfound independence and you're supposed to like put that to the side and just be a responsible student.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was really difficult, but it's exciting time to be in New York.
What were your first impressions? Because it sounded like from your transition that you kind of had like a little culture shock from like being at home to like being in New York. Was there something that like really scared you like when you first got there? It's like, oh shit, like I'm really in New York now.
Yeah, I mean, like I just remember because I lived on like a really busy street and there was just, it was like nonstop commotion. Like, you know, you hear sirens, it feels like every like 5 minutes.
Yeah, we just heard one.
You know, yeah. It's just like buses, horns, people
yelling.
Yeah, just like it never got quiet. And like the suburbs, you know, they're quiet, man. It's like it's scary quiet out there sometimes, you know. And like darker too, you know.
So did you have trouble sleeping those first few days?
Yeah, exactly. Like just like a lot of stimulation. Like
it is. But then like I mean you get used to it, right?
You know? Sure, yeah.
You just drown it out.
Yeah, yeah. I got used to it and you know, you start to stay up later, you start to kind of embrace like that, you know, 24/7 sort of New York City lifestyle.
I bet. And it's such a different time to be. I think you were at the right age to like to live there. Cause me being like in my 30s now is like I don't want to go over there. It's fun to visit.
Yeah,
I'm not
exactly
trying to move over there.
Yeah, I recommend like everybody at least visit if you can. Maybe like try to spend a few months there or like a year or two. But I agree. I think I got that out of my system. It was a lot of fun, but it'd be difficult for me to continue living
there. To transition
there.
It's such a
or
grind.
Transition back, yeah.
Oh my God. When I'm here in LA, I have, you know, my autopilot mode whenever I'm taking public transportation and I'm getting where I need to go. Usually to work, right? I don't even think about it. And sometimes because I'm not even thinking about it, I miss my stop and have to double back.
Yeah, yeah.
But in New York, I'm always there in New York for fun. On vacation, never stressing about work or daily life. So for me, I'm just like walking around, like, ah, la, la. Oh, look at that tall building. Oh, there's the halal guy's car. And it's funny because when I'm on public transportation here in LA, I was like, I don't care. I'm going to the back. I'm sitting in my chair, getting my spot in the train, whatever. And in New York, I'm just like, oh, please have this seat right after you. Or my girlfriend got mad at this, Marisol. She's like, why are you helping all these people? Because I would see, you know, women with baby strollers trying to get down the stairs and there's no elevators or anything.
Yeah.
Which tripped me the fuck out. And I was like, well, let me help you, like, take your baby up or down the stairs.
Yeah, that's a good move. Yeah. That's a New York move.
So I was like, where is this Eric coming from? This, like, nice public transportation where, like, you know, you hear the stories about everybody's just a jerk in New York about,
yeah,
getting on the train. I mean, and there was some of that. Like, I did see puke and rats, you know, and people just going about their day. So I'm not going to say it's all, like, sunshine and flowers. But, yeah, I'm there on vacation and having fun. But for you in college, what did you graduate? Did you finish?
No, I didn't graduate. I went there for 3 years. And then, with film school especially, it's like a lot of people don't finish because they end up starting to work and you know, freelance and stuff. So I got into shooting music videos, producing music videos.
No way.
And started getting some work. And then I also had a couple of accidents that kind of made it really difficult for me to focus on school. So after 3 years, I
it's like a lot of life happening all at once.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot, and I think I got enough out of it, and, you know, I made connections, people that I still stay in touch with, and, I got what I needed out of that experience.
Nice. So you decided, you know, I'm done with school. You obviously have established enough of a work routine and connections where, like, you're getting jobs regularly, right? So how long were you in New York after that?
I was in New York for, total about 8 years. So, yeah, I was in New York for 4 or 5 years after that.
So, the majority of your 20s.
Yeah.
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 What was the turning point where you're like, all right, I'm cool. I'm time to go somewhere else.
Well, it was another sort of abrupt change. I basically lived in the same apartment for my whole time living in
New
York.
No way. Was it rent controlled?
It wasn't rent controlled, but I had really, really sweet landlords who basically never raised the rent. And
you got to know them more on a personal level.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, we got pretty close. But unfortunately, both of them passed away, and their kids, you know, inherited the property.
Oh,
and
kids.
Yeah, everything kind of changed.
Sounds like they were waiting for that so they could flip the building over or something.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, yeah. And it was sad because my landlady, she grew up in the building. It was a 1920s building.
Wow, so it's not a tenement, right? Like one of those old, like...
No, but, I mean, pretty similar. It was like a 4-story brownstone. And
oh,
yeah,
that
had,
is
like,
an
those
old
apartments
ass building.
That are like really deep, almost like railroad style. The stairs were like, it sounded like they were gonna fall apart.
Whoa, was the furnace powered by coal or what?
It had like those old water heaters that like take forever to circulate all the water through, and then it gets super, super hot, like too hot. It was an amazing building to live in, but it was old, you know, there's a lot of like little problems and stuff you had to put up with. But I had to move and find a new place, and LA had kind of always been in the back of my mind. I had siblings that grew up out here and family. So when it came time to find a new place, I was like, you know, let me check out LA. And
nice. Yeah, because, I mean, it's one thing to come and be like, oh, I'm just going to go over there and see what happens. But at least you have family and a network to support you to come over. How was the transition?
I mean, another thing, fortunately, I was coming out here you know, for a couple months or a couple weeks.
All right.
Yeah.
So that gave you time to, like, get used to things, see the neighborhood, see where you wanted to live?
Yeah, and also I forgot to mention I fell in love with an LA native who had no interest in moving to New York.
Yeah, that happens.
So I had that going for me. And family. So, I mean, it was kind of like a no-brainer for me. I was really excited and had been coming out here before, so.
Nice. So you were ready for the transition.
For sure, yeah.
Nice. So when did you come out to LA? Like, I think you said like 4 or 5 years ago, no?
Yeah, I think it was at the very end of 2015, or like close to the end of 2015. So
nice. How's it been so far?
Amazing, man. I love it out here.
Being in New York for almost a decade, was it hard to get used to like the differences in food and like the availability or like the less availability? Well, I should say different availability than like what you normally get in New York.
Yeah, I mean, not so much food, but just like, you know, convenience or being close to stuff. I was in Manhattan and in a really like convenient, centrally located part of Manhattan, so. You know, when I moved here, me and my girlfriend were living in a really small studio in Silver Lake, because she had a job over there. And, you know, in Silver Lake, if you're in the hills, like, you're not really that close to much stuff.
No.
You gotta walk, like, almost like a mile probably to get to anything, like, through these crazy hills.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
So I felt like, you know, kind of like a little bit trapped and like landlocked, I guess, but, you know, start to explore, and you know, I really liked to like that I could skateboard all year round and stuff like that, and I had a bike at the time, so took advantage over stuff like that.
Nice. Yeah, so it didn't seem like a big jump, because I mean, most of the time when you talk to somebody from New York, they're like, oh, this place sucks.
Yeah,
these little bagels. Yeah, you put pineapple on your pizza. Oh, your transportation system sucks. Like, complain. But then, like, look, we're in November. It's nice and toasty right now.
Yeah, man.
You know?
Yeah. I feel like it really helped that, like you said, I had some sort of a support system. Because, like, most of what I saw, like my experiences in L.A. was all through the lens of, like, people that lived here their entire lives.
They're taking
never
you all
lived
the
anywhere
spots.
Else. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, that really helped me. I mean, if I had just moved here not knowing anybody or anything, I might have been one of those New York assholes.
Stuck in Silver Lake or Echo Park.
Yeah.
Have you been to Senor Fish? So, you moved to LA. What work were you doing?
When I moved to LA, I started getting more into shooting documentaries, short documentaries, branded content. But it honestly took me a while. I mean, it was a struggle. I basically had to, like, you know, I had family here and stuff. But I had to kind of recreate my network of, you know, people that were working in film and video. So it took me some time, and it definitely wasn't easy. Went on, like, a lot of interviews, and, you know, people were into my work and interested in it, but I just found that there weren't really enough positions. You know, it was like, especially with like video work, oftentimes like the type of video work I was doing is like they're hiring one or two people to do everything, you know.
Oh.
So it was frustrating. Yeah. But I did kind of branch off into doing work that I hadn't done before in New York.
Like what?
Which was like short documentaries that were focused on people, like the project that I was working on in Skid Row that led me to kind of get into reporting on homelessness.
Nice.
That was a branded content documentary. But yeah, I mean, it was great in some ways, but also really like challenging.
Yeah, I mean, you got most of your network through New York. You had your little niche, and now you got to start all over, which is super scary, man. And props to you, you know, moving over here for your partner, but also, you know, taking the risk of, like, you essentially, for your career, you kind of had to start all over again, even though you have, like, your set of skills, and you can produce work, and you have a body of work already. So, yeah, I can only imagine how you must have been struggling in that. Was there a time where you were, like, maybe questioning, like, what decisions you were making because you were struggling?
Yeah, for sure, man. Many times. I mean, yeah, there was some low moments. I mean, there's for about a year I had to take, you know, a job that I really didn't want to do.
But you need to support yourself rather than like find something that's fulfilling.
Yeah. But you know, always still taking photos and still creating stuff. But yeah, I mean, I definitely had to kind of, like, stick to my guns and be like, no, this is going to pay off. This is going to work out.
Yeah, man. Know? I mean, that's the story for so many creatives, not just in LA, but almost everywhere, right? Especially when you're younger and you're starting, where you have to have your day job and you do your creative fulfillment on the side, whatever you can.
Yep.
So, yeah, man. I'm glad you stuck through it.
Me too, man. I am. I mean, I almost gave up a couple of times, you know?
It's hard. It's, I mean, honestly, the hardest part is that we live in this capitalist society, and nobody cuts you any slack. You need to pay your rent. You need to pay your bills. You know, nobody's going to say, all right, just get me next time. Let me just get some of your photos.
Yeah, exactly.
So with that being said, that, you know, you've been transitioning and you're moving coast to coast, but at the same time, you've been always documenting your life. Do you have just boxes and boxes of, like, photos and, like, negatives and everything?
Oh yeah, tons, man. I have a lot of work still in New York, like, a lot of my New York-based stuff. And then I have stuff here as well. But, yeah, just boxes and boxes of negatives and hard drives and content.
Man, what did... Do you ever get frustrated? Like, I got no more space. It's like, what do I got to do here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of at the point where I've taken over my girlfriend's apartment, and she's pretty annoyed by, like, all the prints and, you know, equipment and stuff that's lying around.
Yeah,
so,
I bet.
I mean, yeah, like, I guess my dream would be to have a space where I could really just, you know,
studio.
Put everything, everything in one place.
Dang. So with you know, you moving over here and kind of trying to balance the act of, like, paying the bills, but then also, you know, being creative and still working, where was the transition from you working in documentaries and doing video to you wanting to write? Like, how did that happen?
So I started writing about, like, 6 or 7 years ago.
Okay.
But it wasn't, like, the main thing I was doing. It was just kind of an opportunity I had to earn a little bit of money while I was doing documentaries and stuff. The change really happened when I got linked up with LA Taco, which was through Daniel.
Daniel editor. Hernandez.
Yep. Who's a good friend of my girlfriend's, and we were friends for years before I heard anything about LA Taco.
Huh.
And then he actually approached me about interviewing me about my photography work, doing like a little profile on the some of the neighborhoods in LA that I'd been documenting. This was around 2018 when LA Taco was relaunching.
Yeah.
And that never happened, but Daniel encouraged me to start contributing photos and photo essays to LA Taco. And that's really just how it all started. Like I said, I began reporting on homelessness and Skid Row, and then that led to another story. And eventually I went from just shooting photos and maybe writing like a paragraph or two to actually doing, you know, larger features and interviews and stuff like that.
Yeah. Dude, how was that transition for you? Because for a lot of folks, especially, you know, a lot of the other folks that are part of LA Taco, most of us, even me, I took the traditional route. I went to school and that's what I studied. And, you know, you get internships and you write for other places. And now you just happen to be at LA Taco for one reason or another. But for you, you started out in a different way. And now you started developing into a writer. How was that transition?
Yeah, it was interesting because I really had to, like, learn as I was going, like, as I was going through the process, you know. I didn't know what I was doing, honestly. Like, I took a lot of guidance from Daniel. He helped me out a lot. You know, I didn't know what a lead was. I didn't know how to, like, outline. I didn't know, like, how to structure stories, really. I just was down to write and, you know, knew that I kind of had, like, a unique perspective on things, I guess.
Yeah, dude, you totally have all those tools and skill sets. To be able to do this, and the fact that you've been doing this for the last almost 3 years now is proof in itself, you know, that you have such a great eye and such a great perspective, and now as you continue to grow as a writer, you know, you're telling all these amazing and deep stories. But yeah, I mean, I would say the same to a lot of folks, that a lot of folks have the foundation to get into this kind of work and storytelling, and, you know, like some of the technical things that you mentioned, like on how to structure things and how to write a lead and how to write for journalism, you know, those are things that you can learn in so many different ways. So, you know, yeah, again, shout out to Daniel for, like, bringing you on and, like, really coaching you into this, because, yeah, I don't think you don't think you would be doing this if it wasn't for him, right?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, like I said, I was writing, but it wasn't on, like, the same level as what I've been doing with LA Taco. And yeah, I really credit Daniel, because not everyone would do that, you know. Like, he was really good about bringing people on and coaching them and, like, nourishing their skills. And you know, a lot of other people that contributed to Taco kind of started the same way that I did.
Yeah, that's one thing that's so awesome, you know, providing that space for folks to grow into themselves and not expecting them to just come out and, like, have all the necessary skills, like, right up in front. So that's awesome. And some of the first stories that you wrote for LA Taco were movie reviews.
Yep.
You wrote a review for Blind Spotting, Sorry to Bother You, If Beale Street Could Talk. I remember seeing Sorry to Bother You in San Francisco in the Mission at the Alamo Draft House. Because all the Oakland shows were sold out. The same for Blind Spotting.
Yeah.
And then we saw Beale Street at the Arclight, but that experience was tainted because I went to the Arclight, to the Dome, and the chair I was sitting on, it wasn't until after I got up that I realized it was just, like, nasty and filthy, like, seat. I was like, like,
paying all that money.
Yeah, like, oh, seat. Let's go to the Arclight, you know, like, have this movie experience, nasty ass seat.
Oh, man.
Looks like it was out there for months.
That sucks.
So I was like, screw the Arclight, I'm just gonna keep going to somewhere else, like LA Live or something. But yeah, you started out writing those reviews. You started doing what LA Taco had done by a couple of different other folks, the Nug Report, which is like you're reviewing weed.
Yeah, that was fun.
And then from there, that's where you start, at least for me, that's where I started seeing the transition, you know, looking at all the different stories you've been writing and where you've been, like, kind of going where you started finding your beats, where you started focusing. Obviously, you started writing about weed reviews, but then you started writing about the different disparities of like how some cities are like opening up restaurants and doing all these cool things, but other folks are still being arrested at higher rates and being criminalized, and the whole system for people to get it was safe to say like a weed license, no, like a dispensary license. You know, it's the system is broken. It's usually going to folks who have a lot of money and resources.
Yep.
and not the folks who, you know, are looking to create their own business, and yeah, the equity programs that they try to establish not working.
Yep.
So you get into that, you start getting into the folks having homeless issues, houseless issues, from two perspectives. From, you know, what we were talking about earlier, you centering people's stories and their experiences and what happened to them, and then also giving us the nitty gritty of like the city isn't doing enough. I know you were. It felt like you were harassing the neighbor, the mayor, with the hand washing stations at a lot of places. Because you would go and you post it on social media and be like, "Yo, what's going on here?
Yep.
You know, there's no water here. There's no soap here. You liar! You're lying about what you're saying." And then yeah, dude. And then getting into what I think is also another heavier topic is, which is like, people getting, you know, killed and violence by the police in all the different cities. So, yeah, dude, like, just how do you manage, you know, kind of dealing with these heavy topics?
Man, yeah, I mean, obviously I was reporting on homelessness and housing, and I think I got into like the justice aspect just because it's really difficult to report on housing without looking at, you know, things like how the police play into, you know, homelessness and housing. And one thing that really guided my writing was covering the shooting of Ryan Twyman, who was killed by sheriff's deputies a year ago.
In Compton, right?
In Compton, yeah. So covering that, he was killed on a weekend when I think over four or five people were killed by law enforcement, and actually interacting with his family and friends, that really changed me as a journalist. You know, I wasn't sitting at home just reading a police report or something. You know, I was talking
to them over the phone.
Yeah, I was getting to know like the people that knew this person, this father, this young man, and that's when I really started to get into covering the police, and police shootings, and I've actually continued to kind of follow that story over the last year, the Ryan Twyman story. Me and my friend Brian have been working on a documentary about that shooting, about shootings in Los Angeles. So for me, I mean, it's just when you hear those stories of family members losing loved ones to police violence, it's not something that I can ignore, right? I think it'd be difficult for people to ignore that. You know, obviously in Los Angeles, unfortunately, a lot of people are killed by police.
Yeah.
You know, so it's something that I'm constantly getting dragged into because there's just, you know, people are being killed constantly.
Yeah, and with Ryan's case, I think the last update, at least from the city side, is that the family is going to be awarded $3 million.
Yeah. Which is a sign that, I mean, the district attorney still hasn't ruled on the case, but, you know, George Gascon was elected DA, and he has said publicly multiple times that he's going to re-examine some officer-involved shooting cases and hopefully charge more officers.
Yeah, dude, because how are you going to give a family whose loved one was killed by the police millions of dollars but not be convicted, you know, of doing something wrong? You're obviously paying them, so
not even put on trial.
Yeah,
you know? not even charged with anything. You know, I think people at the very least would like to see some sort of like a criminal proceeding of like,
yeah, you know, holding justice people accountable in some way.
Let a jury decide, you know.
Because I mean, there's no amount of money that was gonna bring the family member back.
No,
but
I mean, yeah, Ryan was the father of three. I don't think that you can put a monetary amount on not having a father, you know, three kids not having a father for the rest of their life.
Yeah, and this is something you've covered in different aspects in all of your stories, right? That the city and the district attorney's office, the county, they all spend so much money, you know, just paying off people's cases of police violence, but the system just at this point it just keeps getting worse. And as you've been seeing in the protests, as folks have been seeing around the country, I think more and more folks are really waking up and like really seeing it for what it is. And it's, in a way, I know you've talked about this before, I think maybe on social media, where, you know, what's going on today is really similar to what happened with like Rodney King in 92, right? Where everybody knew this was happening and then it was on video, and that just kind of really solidified everybody's like belief and what they saw, that this is what's going on in the communities, but everybody else outside of it just refuses to accept it or acknowledge it or really validate it. And now folks are really just, I think, at that moment again where we've been seeing this for so long, and now other folks are really starting to see, okay, yeah, this is it's not a movie stereotype, it's not a hood like joke or anything like that, it's real. And now I think it also has to do with that violence bleeding over into their communities as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like Black Lives Matter has, you know, made a real point of letting people know that, you know, people in L.A. are being killed by police rates higher than almost anywhere else in the country, you know. So there's George Floyd's and Eric Garner's in L.A. I just don't think that those cases have necessarily gotten the amount of attention that some of those national cases have.
No, because I remember, I think it was either in 2019, where we both kind of like realized the same thing, where ever since the LAPD took over Metro's policing duties, so from the sheriffs, at least in LA County and in the city, there was an uptick in people getting shot and getting killed on the trains because of so many different issues.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you see how police intersect with all these different institutions. And, I mean, recently there was somebody was shot at a UCLA hospital.
Yeah.
By a sheriff's deputy.
The sheriffs.
You know.
Yeah, dude. It's a lot to deal with. So, with you covering this, this summer it took on a different shape because you were also going out to the different protests that were happening over the summer. And in one of them, the one that happened in May 30th at the Grove, you I guess we're in this surreal moment because so many things were happening. And you wrote about this for LA Talk. You reflected about what that moment was like, what you were going through, everything that was happening. Tell folks a little bit about what was going on, like with the protest, and why you were there, and then what was that moment of reflection for you?
Sure. Yeah. So this was May 30th, and this was actually the first day. George Floyd was killed on the 25th, and protests broke out almost immediately.
Yeah.
You know, and I hadn't been out covering the protest until May 30th, which turned out to be a really intense day. And I remember before I went out, I actually debated whether or not I should bring my video camera or not. Because in the previous days, some of the protests had escalated to violence. I was concerned about the equipment being damaged, but I made the decision to bring my cameras. And I headed out to the Grove and caught up with Black Lives Matter, who had marched from Pan Pacific Park.
Yeah, this was on a Saturday, I remember, because it was
yep.
a big action.
Yeah.
And it was very intentional to be there, too.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, I remember, like, me and my buddy Brian, we were like, why are they having this here, you know? Like, this park is not really, like, the best place for an action, but we realized, you know, it was more about targeting that area.
Yeah.
But yeah, we caught up with them, and they basically marched in, you know, a circle west, and then headed back east towards the park. And then things just started erupted when the police basically blocked them off and interfered with them getting back to the park, and escalated from there. And
that was still LAPD, right?
Yeah, this was LAPD. And I was down there documenting for hours.
And live tweeting too, like
live tweeting. That's when I like made the decision to kind of like live tweet as well. So I was like figuring things out, you know. I'd covered protests going back to like 2014, 2015 in New York. But this was like, you know, I'd never been in anything like this really, you know. Police shooting, non-lethal rounds, less lethal rounds, excuse me, at crowds of people, and, you know, setting up skirmish lines and hundreds
that
of police.
We've been seeing,
I ended up, while I was documenting police interacting with protesters, a metropolitan police officer turned to me and very quickly jabbed me in the stomach with their baton, which sent me flying back into a group of people and almost lost my camera. So yeah, that was my first day out covering the protest after George Floyd was killed. And it's a day that I will definitely never forget.
Yeah, because I would recommend folks going to LA Taco and reading the story. This protest happened in March, but Lex May. The protest happened in May, and you wrote the reflection like almost a month later in June. So it's definitely worth a read. But in it, you reflected on two big things. The first one was you being there as a journalist, but then also really just questioning that, right? You're there as a journalist, you're documenting. You were obviously going to publish the photos, and you were publishing some videos and photos on social media as it was happening, but then also having this conflict, right? Where you're there as a journalist and you're supporting, but then, you know, you saw what was going on with other people being arrested and how they were being treated, and you kind of straddling that line. What was going on through your mind in that?
Yeah, this was back when the city had established curfews, and you know, thousands of people were being arrested.
Yeah,
hundreds of people like per night.
This is when Metro like cut their service and like left people stranded.
Yeah, so people were really suffering. You know, people that were protesting, but also people that just got caught up in, you know, like trying to get home from work, and you know, there's a curfew, and they called a dispersal order, and suddenly they're arrested. So folks were going through a lot, and I was documenting a lot of that, you know, people being arrested, you know, handcuffed. You know, I was conflicted in those moments because as a journalist, there's a certain level of privilege that you have. You know, I'd literally document dozens of people being arrested. Excuse me.
That's a LAPD chopper.
Speaking of the LAPD, yeah, they would arrest, you know, dozens of people and then get to me. I'd show my press pass and they'd back off. If I didn't have that press pass, you know, I would have been in handcuffs. So there's a certain level of privilege, and, you know, people that are protesting or in handcuffs, they definitely recognize that. And, you know, some people view the media as just as problematic at times as the cops, you know. And I have seen problematic media there, you know, people that are you know, trying to kind of capitalize off of other people's struggle.
So what was it for you after that protest? Because you were going through a lot, and you know, you wrote in the piece that a lot of folks are reaching out to you personally, that just get out of there, you know, it's not worth it, like we want you to be safe. So what was it for you to balance that, where you know, you have everybody who cares about you telling you be safe or to get out of there, but you wanting to stay there? How were you like balancing that?
I mean, it was scary. I described it as one of the scariest days of my life, and it definitely was. but I also found ways to make sure that I felt safe enough to be there, I would say. But looking back, when I read other people's, accounts of what happened that day or reports about some of the injuries that were sustained, I definitely do think, like, you know, what was I thinking? What was I doing? You know, it's like people got seriously injured and harmed. So I guess it's one of those things where, like, I'm not really going to put myself in a situation where I feel unsafe to the point where, you know, I need to get out there.
Yeah.
Get out of there. If I need to get out of there, then I'm going to get out of there.
Yeah, because another point you made in the piece was you reflecting on how you are literally putting your body on the line to be out there and to cover this. And as you said it, you know, you're putting your body out there on the line for pennies while other reporters, you know, are phoning this in from home and just, like, really being so distant and disconnected from what's actually happening there. So what kind of made you realize that?
Yeah, that was an interesting time period because we were dealing with the pandemic. You know, we were still really in the thick. I mean, we still are, obviously.
Yeah, that was like end of May, beginning of June, yeah.
Yeah, so at the time, I mean, this is one of the big reasons why I think LA Taco really sort of thrived during that time period. A lot of news organizations were relying on freelancers. They weren't, you know, they couldn't send their staff, you know, staff people out there. Mm. So they were relying on freelancers to go out there and, you know, do the difficult work of dodging less lethal munitions while also trying to report.
Yeah, a lot of photographers, a lot of videographers.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, it there was less people out there. There's less people covering. So that gave people like me and LA Taco an opportunity to tell these stories that, you know, other organizations weren't really covering at the time. But it did become very clear because, you know, when you're on the front lines and you're seeing stuff and then you see other organizations reflect on it and just, you know, it's not really an accurate representation of what was going on.
You're getting the news version of it. Like, this happened, this many people, the stats, you know, people got arrested, vehicles got this, storefronts got that, da-da-da-da-da-da. And maybe somewhere in between, somebody will get quoted as like, this is unfair, the police suck, da da da. But I also did want to talk about how you were in the middle of all of this. All of this is going on around you, and you mentioned this, you know, when you started telling the story, you were thinking about taking your cameras. So you took two cameras. You took your video, the digital camera. And I think you always carry like a film camera with you,
yep,
right?
Yep.
So in the middle of all of that, you managed to snap a photo of a burning cop car with what was the billboard sign in the vaccine?
It's Dead to Me, I guess, a show.
Yeah. Dude, so you kind of turned that into like a super iconic image because you turned that into a print, and like folks have just been like, every time you put it out there, I think you've had to do like what, three editions, two?
Yeah, I've done two editions and I might do a third.
Yeah. So what was it that for that photo for you that stood out there? Like, you know what, let me see if I can do something more with this.
Well, yeah, it was like, as somebody that's trying to record video and also trying to shoot photos and then also just trying to report, like write and tweet, which, you know, it's to share with people on Twitter, but it's also kind of like a way to report, you know, to take notes and stuff. I often like struggle with, wait, what do I do in this moment? Do I record the video? Do I write about it?
Only
do I shoot
have
the
two
photo?
Hands.
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, I haven't taken that many photos, but with my photo work, I rather take like one really great photo than a bunch of like mediocre photos or even just a bunch of photos. The way I shoot with film is that it's basically like one shot and that's kind of it.
That speaks to your experience in like years of like taking photos.
I mean, what I learned is that like, cause I used to not do that. I would, you know, shoot a portrait of somebody, landscape, and then horizontal and then vertically. But when you have so many options with film, it's really difficult to like pick what you really like.
Yeah.
So I just limit it to basically one shot. And then if I'm shooting the same subject, I'll try to create a different shot. But in that moment, I mean, it was a really hectic, intense moment because there was a burning cop car, which was like a couple of feet away from a gas station. And there's all these people, like, you know, some people are taking selfies in front of it. Yeah. Other people are like, back up, like, this thing could blow up, which wasn't necessarily so much a threat. Like, I talked to the fire department after, and they were like, you're fine, don't worry about it. Like, it's not going to blow up like you see in the movies.
Yeah, these a lot of cop cars, I would think that they're built and they have, like, protected gas tanks and things like that.
The worst thing that could happen is, like, ammunition, you know, that could definitely explode.
Yeah, I think that would be more of a concern.
Yeah, but yeah, it was just a really chaotic moment, and I was shooting video, but I managed to snap a 35mm photo, and I actually sat on it for a long time, and I didn't know how I felt about it. Mm. I didn't really want to, you know, highlight the violence too much, or... You know, glorify this cop car being burned. But over time, I sat with it and I kind of recontextualized it. And just seeing the juxtaposition of that sign and the traffic lights and, you know, the way that things kind of cleared out in that moment for me to take that photo really stood out to me. And yeah, I think it's probably the most, like, popular image I've ever
yeah,
shot.
Yeah, I mean, it's up there. To me, that's one of the photos I think of from, like, that's this world that summer. Like, talking about it, like, like it happened years ago. A
couple months ago.
Yeah, because, dude, so much was going on. It was ridiculous. It was nuts. And, you know, I'm glad you're safe. You know, I'm glad you were able to do your work. And I'm also glad to hear that, you know, that experience helped you, you know, come to terms with yourself. That, like, yeah, I don't need to be out there all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I mean, it was tough at first, man. Cause, like, you know, I was basically out every day, you know, from May 30th until, you know, maybe like mid or late June. And then I had to actually make a point of not going out, mm-hmm. sitting down, writing, and, like, just taking everything in. While there was still so much going on,
yeah.
You know? I mean, there was stuff that I wanted to cover that I couldn't cover the way I wanted to, but at the end of the day, I think it was a good decision.
Yeah, because aside from that, you've been covering a lot of, like, the Black Lives Matter actions, specifically the ones where they go harangue the mayor at their house.
Yep. Yeah, there's been a couple of secret protests that I was fortunate enough to be invited to and cover.
So how do you handle that trust where, you know, people are trusting you to be like, all right, you're cool, you can be part of this because, you know, we trust your work. How do you handle it?
Super important to me. I mean, I respect, you know, their demands as far as keeping things on the DL and, you know, just listening to what they say as far as when they want to actually publicize things. And just respecting the fact that I was one of the few people to be invited.
Yeah, man.
And, yeah, you know, just trying to stay safe and stuff like that.
Well, let's move over to one of the heavier stories that you wrote. And I think it took a while for you to write it because you were really, like, investigating and really getting into the trenches of what was going on with this story of two young men, two Latino men, both of them named Daniel, who got killed in the span of a week. And then you connect that to the history, to one of the most fucked up departments in the LAPD, the Newton Division, or as they like to call themselves, Shootin' Newton. I remember seeing at a cafe once one of their badges on the table.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it had the Punisher logo on it and Shootin' Newton with the clover. I was like, fuck this, I'm never coming back here again.
Do you remember where that was?
Yeah, it's the pancake place over on Adams, over by across the street from the church, and they, like, next to USC. It's like in a little plaza. Jackson Flips or something like that. Don't ever go there. which is something that has tripped me out. Like, even that, if you've been to Nick's over by Chinatown.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, when you said that, I was like, yeah.
A lot of like, classic diners, at least the good ones, have, like, a lot of pro-cop, pro-whatever, paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Like, hats and badges and stuff like that. And I've always been like, but... It's so good.
Yeah. Gigi's down the street is like that because Metropolitan Division's right down the street.
Yeah. So. I mean,
they don't have like the memorabilia and paraphernalia or whatever, but there's a lot of cops that go in there.
Yeah. So I'm like, let's leave that for another time. I'm hungry right now. But yeah, you get into that with Newton. But then also like the social media celebrity cop, Tony McBride, mm-hmm. who... After reading your piece, I was like, what the fuck? Like, I didn't know they were in that level of celebrity status where they were working with so many other folks like Keanu Reeves and like a bunch of other action movie stars. So tell folks like what the story is and what happened.
Yeah, so this story was a lot to unpack. I found out about it, Daniel Hernandez, the first Daniel Hernandez that was killed. In April, his sister and his family, after the protests broke out for George Floyd, and then after Andreas Guardado was shot, family came out and started organizing again. And, the story of Daniel Hernandez started to recirculate a bit. So some people tipped me off about Toni McBride and her competitive shooting career.
Yeah.
She's not only an LAPD officer, but she's also a competitive shooter and sort of like a gun influencer and celebrity influencer.
And the daughter, remind me?
The daughter of Jamie McBride, who is a board member of one of the LAPD unions.
Yeah, there you go.
And just really like interesting story, dynamic story. There, like you mentioned, there is a bunch of videos of Tony training with celebrities and actors at this gun range in Los Angeles. That was founded by a gun trainer who's, trained a bunch of celebrities, but also been accused of sexual misconduct, sexual harassment. So when all this fell on my desk, it was just, it was a lot to process. And I ended up connecting the dots and realizing that there was another Daniel Hernandez that had been killed. And just within a week span in the same division, about a mile apart from where the first Daniel Hernandez was killed, which to me really highlighted the fact that Latinos are killed so often by police in Los Angeles. We hear Black Lives Matter a lot, and, there's been sort of a movement to... highlight the stories of brown people and, Latino people that have been killed by the police as well. So to me, this story was about, highlighting those statistics, but also the stories of the Daniels that were killed. And in the process of doing that, I found out that Daniel Hernandez, who was killed in April, actually had an experience with the police years prior. There was a lawsuit. So he had a traumatic experience with the police already. And, to me that really stood out that he had this experience and then years later was killed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think for a lot of us, we have our own stories of like how the cops are dicks in so many different ways. And it is traumatizing. Cause it's there. It's part of you. It's the kind of trauma that doesn't just leave. Cause the cops are everywhere. Especially nowadays with everything that's going on. It's not easy to just see the cops do what they do in their riot gear, and like what happened to you? Get jabbed in the stomach with the baton, shoot people with beanbags, pepper balls, all that crazy military equipment that, you know, they've been using. And it's just nuts that you wrote the story. I'm trying to like find the chronological order here. You wrote the story, you published it, and then from there you started seeing other folks picking it up, right?
Yeah. So we published it with LA Taco, and then in the weeks after that, a couple other publications did a very similar story, and then it actually blew up to be a national story. I think like the New York Post wrote a story about it. Like, it became big news, and most people, you know, they focused on the fact that Tony McBride was this competitive shooter.
Yeah, they have a high model profile
and an influencer. But yeah, I mean, I was happy to see that, you know, people were writing about Daniel Hernandez and the family, and bringing some attention to Tony McBride. But you know, it was a little bit surprising to see that LA Taco wasn't really mentioned at all in a lot of those stories.
Yeah, that tends to happen a lot.
Yeah, we know how that feels at LA Taco.
with you having, you know, being out there in the protests and writing about the police, do you feel that you're being watched? Like, maybe like people are keeping an eye on you?
I mean, it's interesting. Both times that I was attacked by the police, there was Metropolitan Division officers involved. And Metropolitan's a really small division, you know, there's like 300 officers, I think. So it's not hard to imagine that they're aware of me. You know, I got, you know, coverage from that. I did interviews and stuff. So it wouldn't shock me if they're aware of me. But I'm not sure exactly, you know, how targeted I am.
Yeah, it's something I think about, because I remember when like the Occupy protests were happening, and even some of the protests I've been in, that's when folks really started being the wiser to a lot of the basically spying equipment that the cops use, using stingrays,
yep,
using, you know, cell phone data, looking at your social media. I know probably not the only organization now, but I remember reading a couple of years ago how the sheriff's department was one of the first police organizations in the city to establish like a e-division, you know, like doing, I mean, they basically established that to find parties where people are selling Nas and like helium and shit like that. They had one cop looking on Facebook for where the gig at and like where's the party at. But that obviously developed into like a whole bunch of other things. And even the LAPD now, you know, they have their own division for tracking all of that. So I have no doubt, you know, that you were probably like being monitored on social media, or like people are listening to this conversation right now.
Yeah. One thing that actually happened in the summer, like while I was covering all those protests, is there were a couple cops that recognized me and asked like about LA Taco and stuff. And then there's some cops that reached out on like replied to my post on Twitter, like just out of the blue and stuff. So yeah, I mean, yeah, I have no doubt. They definitely monitor social media. It's you know, a
and
known.
It's different because it's not like you're at an institution like, oh yeah, that's the LA Times beat reporter. Yeah. It's like, no, it's like, oh, it's that one guy with that one taco place.
Yeah, I even like a detective replied to something I wrote. I posted a video of them, and then they replied to the video of them, just being like, let me know if you want to talk or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, how did you find me? And they were like, somebody sent it to me.
creepers, man. So another story I wanted to like talk to you about was the one of Lionel Morales. Mm-hmm. So this one, it's a tragic story, because the guy, he was just out there living his life, and he gets hit by a car. And if you're not, you know, in the bike advocacy or transportation advocacy world, you know, a hit and run or somebody being hit by a car is not something you think about until it happens to you. And then that's when you learn how fucked up this system is, where people who hit other people with their cars and sometimes do the hit and run, there's no like structured way to hold them accountable, to bring them in. And even if by some miracle that person is arrested and brought in and they go through a court system and judgment is ruled, you know, most of them get away with like slapping the hands. Like, there's no real justice for folks who get hit by cars. So tell folks what happened with Lionel.
Yeah, so Lionel, I was at down the street actually at a liquor store one night and grabbing some stuff, and I was talking to Lionel just right before he got hit, just asking about, you know, because I knew he was unhoused, I'd seen him a lot, just asking about his situation, you know, how did he end up on the streets basically, and you know, we talked briefly, and then he was sweeping the parking lot.
Okay.
And a customer walked out of the store into their car and backed up, pinned him to the ground, and they actually had to like move forward to release
Jesus.
Him. Jesus. And he was just in so much pain, screaming. And the guy at first he got out and he like took him to the side. But he almost immediately started to like blame him for getting in his way, and when I confronted him and asked if he had looked behind to see if anyone was behind him, he started to get like mad at me and aggressive, and you know, just blamed Lionel for getting in his way essentially, and I managed to get a picture of his license plate, but he, you know, got aggressive with me and then quickly fled,
mm-hmm.
without leaving his information or calling 911 or making sure that Lionel was okay. So Lionel ended up breaking his leg, which made the hit and run a felony. And at the time, I didn't know Lionel's name. I just he went by a nickname, and no one really knew his real name or had much information about
him. Yeah, just hanging out, always there.
So I didn't see him for about a month, but I made a point of trying to track him down, and I followed up with the Central Traffic Division, who basically just told me that, look, you know, we're weeks behind on hit and runs. This stuff happens every day,
Jesus.
And we're not going to get this to this for at least, you know, a week or two. And ended up linking back up with Lionel outside of the liquor store. And he was in a wheelchair at the time and had spent about a month in a hospital and then a nursing home. You know, had trouble going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Just really suffered. And, yeah, that's kind of where I picked up with him and just continued to try and figure out, you know, if the driver was going to be held accountable. I had heard what you talked about, you know, just it's very unlikely that people are arrested, and even more unlikely that they're charged with anything mm-hmm. significant. But I didn't know exactly how it worked until I was actually involved in the process. You know, I was a witness to this, and I did a photographic lineup. I spoke, you know, I gave testimony to the police. I gave them evidence and stuff. And for months I didn't hear anything, and I kind of assumed that they were, you know, these things take a while.
Yeah,
I'll hear back eventually.
There's a backlog, yeah.
Yeah, but then I filed a public records request, and I found out that days after I had done the lineup, they had decided not to charge the driver. One of the reasons why was because they couldn't locate Lionel. Which to me is, I mean, I saw him just a couple days ago, and I've seen him like countless times since then. So yeah, it was a really eye-opening experience, and I asked Lionel if he was comfortable with me, you know, publicizing this story in the hopes that it might bring more attention to it and could, you know, help him find some sort of justice or accountability.
Yeah. Yeah, and how What, yeah, just, like, give folks an update. Because I know you wrote the story, and then you followed up. So, like, give folks an update of what happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first update was what I said just about filing public records request and finding out that they declined to charge the driver. And, you know, that obviously made Lionel pretty upset. He was completely in the dark about that, you know. They've never spoken to him.
Nobody reached out.
Nobody reached out to even tell him, you know, what was going on with this. And, I mean, that's been kind of the last major update. But then in the piece that I did for the appeal about the DA's office, I included Lionel's story in that as well. Just as an example of, you know, you think in your head, like, you know, they know who the driver is. They have a license plate. You know, this
You pointed them out.
Yeah, I pointed them out. Like, this is a no-brainer, right? But it's not really how it works, you know. They have a lot of DAs and district attorneys. They have a lot of discretion, you know, about which sort of cases they take on, and you know, the law still kind of looks at hit and runs as accidents, as you know, it's not necessarily the driver's fault, and they don't have a very high conviction rate, so. You know, just learning about the DA's history and, you know, examining some cases, you start to see that they don't really want to go after drivers. You know, they could, but...
It's a pattern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they don't think it's going to win convictions and, you know...
That doesn't look good when they come up for re-election.
Yeah, and like, you know, a lot of district attorneys will say they, you know, they will only take on cases that they think that they can win, because, you know, they can't put innocent people through trials and all this nonsense. But, you know, to a lot of people, it's an excuse to not do anything about something that's a really serious problem in Los Angeles. You know, the amount of people, pedestrians, cyclists that are hit every year. But when I wrote about the story for the appeal, very quickly, a bunch of district attorneys actually, a deputy attorneys actually reached out to me, which was really weird, man. Like, publishing a story on a Saturday or a Sunday, like at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then getting a bunch of like texts and emails from deputy attorneys. But basically, it sounds like, you know, people in that office have read the story and are familiar with it and think that there's more that the district attorney could have done.
All of a sudden.
Not necessarily. And, I mean, the thing is, like, is punishment the solution to this? Like, is punishment going to fix Lionel's leg? Is it going to get him off the streets? Not necessarily. I don't know what he wants out of it. I don't know that he necessarily wants to see somebody in prison or jail. But they also brought up about how the district attorney has, you know, there's things that they can do for victims. There's, you know, there's funds and resources that they can, you know, dish out to people that have been victims of crimes, regardless if anybody goes to jail for it or not. So... You know, I think it's just an example of how the criminal punishment system doesn't work for everybody.
No, it isn't. And I that's a great point about what Lionel would want to see out of this. You know, you were there, you saw, you helped, you told their story. And even then, it took a while for the DA to actually, like, come to their senses and try to do something about it. But... Yeah, what would be the solution? Because, I mean, I think the initial reaction for a lot of us would be, yeah, that guy was wrong. He ran him over, broke his leg. Quote, unquote, justice needs to be done, right? And what does that look like? Does he take their license away? There's a fine? Do they need to go to jail?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's tough, especially with these, you know, with drivers running over pedestrians. I think the thing that Lionel says to me a lot is, you know, it's hard for him to wrap his head around the idea of this guy getting away with it and just not being held accountable at all.
Yeah.
You know, he says to me a lot, like, this guy, he thinks he got away with it. You know, he thinks that he ran me over and that's it. You know, he can still drive. He's, you know, he's still free. I do know that Lionel, he's trying to get housing though. He, you know, he's trying to get housing. He's trying to get more support in other ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, it's like, you know, is locking up this guy, even taking away his license, which, you know, if he's not a safe driver, if, you know, it's a pattern of unsafe driving that could help other people, but it's not going to get Lionel off the street, you know? So, you know, maybe if there was a way to do more for victims, especially, you know, a lot of people that get run over by cars or hit by cars are unhoused people.
Yeah.
And the majority of the people that get hit, like, those hit and runs never get reported.
No.
So, you know, maybe if there was a system to do more for the victims of people in these hit and runs, you know, there'd be, you'd see more of, like, a benefit for them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's something that, you know, I do in the transportation advocacy that I'm a part of, because, yeah, it's just ridiculous. And you always, you know, it's a lot of, like, what you were talking about earlier. You know, you always hear stories. Kids, it's like, we're at a park. There's kids. You always hear stories of folks, you know, suffering violence from the police or something, and it just becomes a 2-minute blip on the 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock news. You know, they'll show you like security footage of the actual the collision happening, and then that's it. Like, folks rarely find justice for the community. So, yeah, it's just one of the amazing stories you've been able to write over these last couple of months, and you know, over time. Through your tenure here at LA Taco.
Thanks, man. It's been a great journey.
Yeah. So with that being said, where is Lex going in these next couple of months? What are you looking forward to?
So I'm looking forward to working on some long-term projects. I'm working on a podcast right now.
Nice.
With Mariah from LA Taco.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Shh. Don't talk about it.
Yeah. Can't talk about the specifics, really. But
but I know.
Yeah. You know. Really excited about that. It's my first time working on a podcast like this. And, you know, it gives me an opportunity to focus on something for several months.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the theme of my work now. I feel like, you know, getting into deeper investigations, getting into more of like the data side of journalism. I'm going to be a part of a fellowship at USC Annenberg.
Yeah, congrats on that. The USC Annenberg Health Journalism Fellowship.
Yes, man. I'm really excited. Going to be reporting on a project that I've been working on throughout the pandemic that focuses on homelessness and the public health crisis. So really excited to report on that, but also to learn about data journalism, which is, you know, I do investigations, but I don't necessarily rely super heavily on data right now. I'm starting to more. But that's kind of a new world for me, which is really exciting. And I'm going to be learning from like some of the top journalists in the country.
Man, it's a great opportunity. And it sounds like at one point you're going to get frustrated when you start dabbling in census data.
Yeah, dude. I started to do that this week and I was like, whoa, this is like, it's a whole
it's
new world
creepy.
To me, but it's like, yeah. It's really interesting.
Let me see how racist people are by neighborhood.
Yeah, that's coming in handy for a lot of like the cannabis reporting and stuff that I'm doing now.
Yeah, dude, so that is awesome. You know, that you're continuing this. Do you see yourself keep being on this track?
As far as like
reporting and you know, keep working for LA Taco, keep you know your career going as a journalist. Yeah.
Kind of. I would like to. I mean, I'm starting to get into stuff that is not necessarily journalism related, but just more storytelling related. So yeah, I mean, it's always been tough for me to like just focus on one thing. And when I started to get into the journalism I've been doing with LA Taco, that's what I really loved. I was like, I found something where, you know, I'm still making videos for LA Taco. I'm still shooting photos. I'm still writing. It's this one thing that really allows me to incorporate all my skills.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, there's other things I want to do. Like, I still want to make films. I still want to write screenplays and documentaries and stuff like that.
A Renaissance man.
But yeah, I do plan on continuing to contribute to LA Taco and do these investigations.
Nice. Sure. So with that being said, where can folks find you on social media?
So you can find me, I'm most active on Twitter when it comes to like reporting. You can find me twitter.com/shotonthirty5mm.
So shotonthirty5mm.
35mm. Yeah. And that's my handle on Instagram as well. My Instagram is solely dedicated to my 35mm photography work. So I don't post as much about my stories, like, you know, my written stuff on there, but starting to. And yeah, those are the two main platforms to find me on.
Yeah.
Also my website, LexisOlivierRay.com.
And like you have on your pinned tweet, you know, support him and buy his photography now before he gets really famous. It's too expensive.
Yeah, I have a little print store to buy some stuff.
Yeah, dude. So I did have a random question. For posting your photos on Instagram, are you scanning like the developed photos? Are you scanning the negatives?
Yeah, so I don't scan them myself, but I get scans of all my negatives.
Yes. Yeah, and, it's a nice little like added bonus when you develop your film.
Oh yeah, I love it. It's so exciting, like when you see photos. Because I mean, my process is really slow too, man. Like, it was only recently, like, I had film that I hadn't developed that I shot in like 2017.
Dang.
So that's like,
you keeping it in the fridge.
Just
like in a cool place.
Yeah, in a cool place, in a dark, cool place. But it's, I mean, that's one of the most exciting things about film, you know, waiting to see your images.
Yeah, I regret some of the photos. I was like, ah, damn it. All these years waiting and I got nothing. That's me.
I mean, if I get 4 to 8 really good photos back in like a 24 to 36 roll, I mean, you know, images, yeah, per roll, yeah, I'm happy.
Nice. Yeah, I always like realize, at some point I realized when you develop and at a place and they give you the digital copies of it, I was like, oh nice, like the new version of a contact sheet.
Yeah
So nice. So yeah, follow Lex on social media. I'll have that and his website linked in the episode description for this episode. But yeah, dude, thanks again.
Thank
for
you,
joining
man.
Me at the park. Please enjoy the coffee cake that I made.
I
and
will.
the cookie. I really just honestly I have a lot more fun baking than eating it.
Same, man. Like every time I make butter or edibles, they usually just sit or I give them away to people.
Yeah, you know, so I've been like, if you follow me on social media, you've been seeing I've been making coffee cake like nuts, like it's nothing. So I'm really good at it now.
I appreciate it, man. This is actually my first time having the coffee cake too.
Yeah, this is the LA USD coffee cake, except, you know, like I explained to you before we started recording, I didn't follow the exact recipe. I used almond milk. I tend to cut back on the sugar a little bit because I think for me, when I first made it, I realized that was the impression we all have in our brain with the coffee cake is that the recipe calls for like 3 cups of sugar from 2 different types of sugar.
Wow.
Yeah.
What else is in it?
So cinnamon, nutmeg, sugar, cinnamon. Flour. It's essentially all sugar.
Yeah.
So that's why it's like, no wonder everybody loves this thing. You eat this like sugary bread as a kid and it's going to like sear into your mind. I remember just some random thing where they analyzed like the neural activity in your brain. And sugar has the same pattern as, like, cocaine.
Wow.
Random fact. So, yeah. Thanks again, Lex.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thanks again, everybody, for listening. And just by random chance, if you're listening to this show because you saw me quoted on the LA Times or in The Guardian, shout out to you.
Hell yeah, man.
All right. This is Out of the Bold Heights, so we'll catch you next time.